we're not always greeted with open arms, but if you find one person, it only takes one who greets you with open arms and really sees that you do have something to offer in life, that makes all the difference. It makes all the difference.
Are you overwhelmed by motherhood and barely keeping your head above water? Are you confused and frustrated by how all the other moms make it look so easy? You can't figure out how to manage the chaos in your mind, your home, or your family. I get you, Mama. Parenting with ADHD is hard. Here is your permission slip to let go of the Pinterest-worthy visions of organization and structure fit for everyone else. Let's do life like our brains do life. Creatively, lovingly, and with all our might. When we embrace who we are and how our brains work, we can figure out how to live our lives successfully and, in turn, lead our families well. At the end of the day, we just want to be good moms. But, spoiler alert, you are already a great mom. ADHD does not mean you're doomed to be a hot mess, Mama. You can rewrite your story from shame spiral to success story. And I'll be right here beside you to cheer you on. Welcome to Motherhood in ADHD. Hey there, successful mama. I am totally fangirling over here today. I was never much into boy bands, but let me talk to one of the godfathers of ADHD. The angels are singing. When you first get diagnosed and you decide you're going to read a book about ADHD, it's more than likely that the book is by Dr. Edward Hallowell and his partner, Dr. John Rady. They've written Driven to Distraction, Delivered from Distraction, and their latest book, ADHD 2.0. Well, Dr. Edward Hallowell is here with us today. He's a board-certified child and adult psychiatrist and basically a world authority on ADHD. He's a graduate of Harvard College and a fellow Tulane alum, and he worked at Harvard Medical School for over 20 years. He has the Hallowell ADHD Centers across the U.S. and has spent over 40 years helping literally thousands of adults and children live well through a strength-based approach to neurodiversity. And what matters most to me, he has ADHD and dyslexia himself, which means he knows what he's talking about from the inside and on the outside. Mama, what an inspiration Ned is on what he has accomplished as someone with ADHD. Today, we're talking about using our strengths and overcoming hurdles and that awful negative self-talk we have. We go through the power of connection, and Ned did not shy away from sharing his own childhood trauma, which affects the way that he loves on others now and the way that he parented his now grown children who also have ADHD. I cannot wait for you to hear the ADHD gold that is going to come from one of my favorite ADHD experts. Let's welcome Dr. Edward Hallowell.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Good. So I love to hear people's diagnosis story and how they came to find out, like, how do you even know you had ADHD? So can you walk us through just, obviously, it's a long story, but the short version of how you even started down the path of thinking perhaps this was the path that you were working on?
Well, I knew from first grade that I had certain challenges when it came to learning because I couldn't read. And back then, that was 1955, I'm 71 years old now. Back then, if you couldn't learn to read, your diagnosis was stupid. and the treatment plan was try harder. You know, they might motivate you to try harder by shaming you, humiliating you. Some kids got spanked to make them try harder. And if that didn't work, well, you were just very stupid. But I was very lucky. I had this wonderful first grade teacher by the name of Mrs. Eldridge. And during reading period, she knew there was more to it than being stupid, but she just didn't know quite what to do. But what she came up with is she would simply come over and sit down next to me. We'd be sitting at these round tables, taking turns reading out loud. And when it would come to be my turn, I'd stammer and I'd stutter. I couldn't do it. But she would simply put her arm around me. And so as I stammered and stuttered, none of the other kid would laugh at me because I had the mafia sitting next to me. And that was my treatment plan. It was Mrs. Eldridge's arm. It was brilliant, though, because it took out of the equation the real disabilities. You know, I have dyslexia. It wasn't called that back then. But the real disabilities are shame and fear and believing you're defective, believing you're a retard, as kids would say. And because of that arm, I didn't acquire those disabilities. By the end of the year, I was still the worst reader in the class. I have dyslexia, but I was the most motivated reader in the class. I really wanted to learn to read. And that never would have happened without Mrs. Eldridge. Gradually, I did learn to read. I'm still an incredibly slow reader. My wife says, I don't know how you know anything. It takes you so long to read. But I majored in English at Harvard College and graduated with high honors while also doing pre-med. So I had to have some kind of cognitive apparatus to do that. And then off I went to medical school and a residency in psychiatry. And when I was starting my fellowship in child psychiatry in 1981, I'll never forget it. I heard a lecture given by Elsie Freeman, this wonderful woman, about a condition that I'd never heard of, attention deficit disorder. If you told me someone had that prior to that lecture, I would have thought it meant they didn't get enough attention growing up. You know, they were neglected. Then I learned the condition in 1981 in that lecture, and it was one of the great aha moments of my life because I realized, that's the rest of the story. I'd known about the dyslexia, the slow reading part, but I hadn't known about the wandering mind part. And also the quirky part, the why I would come up with unusual answers and why I had a sort of a zany sense of humor, and what it all started to fit. And I also realized that the medical model, which I was being taught, left out all the good stuff. And that's where I began my lifelong crusade to let people know this is not altogether a bad thing. In fact, if you manage it right, it's a wonderful thing. It's like a superpower if you manage it right. It can also be a terribly, terribly crippling condition if you don't manage it right. So I learned about it most dramatically in that one lecture, but then I've been learning about it in the ensuing 40 years, you know, because I've learned, and my patients have been my textbook, because the books that had been written didn't include the good stuff. And so I had to learn from my patients, and that they're the best textbook ever. So I always thank all the people who came to me for help, because they gave me help. They taught me what this condition really is, instead of the slanted version that the medical model that I was trained in promulgated.
Well, I love that story because before I stayed home with my boys, I was a middle school teacher. So the fact that you remember her name means
says
a lot.
She changed my life forever.
That's the magic of a teacher who is really there in it with you. So
right.
So in your book, and right at the beginning, you talk about the spectrum of traits. And what you mentioned made me think of when you're talking about that distorted negative self-image, you mentioned that we look at ourselves as if we're in a house of mirrors, not seeing ourselves as others do, seeing only what we regard as failures and shortcomings, all but blind to the upside, which is typically considerable. So knowing that you struggled so much throughout school in your reading, how do you overcome But internally, obviously you had your cheerleaders there with you, but internally, how do you overcome that negative self-talk and not walk around with such a giant imposter syndrome, which I think so many people with ADHD are wearing like a coat of, not even a coat of armor, but like just a huge weight on them. They can't move forward.
Yeah, I was lucky because for whatever reason, I was able to excel academically. I had a high IQ. I had teachers who gave me what I needed. They recognized that I had creativity, originality, and they valued that. I went to private school, you know, so I wasn't sort of, you know, mass produced the way, unfortunately, public education often does. So my heroes are teachers because they really found my talents and like I like to say, unwrapped my gifts. So I had a very positive self-image. I knew I was smart. I knew I could do well. I also knew I was different. But I embraced that difference because it didn't seem to hold me back. The fact that I'm a slow reader, that was a pain in the butt. But because, you know, I remember in high school reading Crime and Punishment, really the book that got me excited about literature. And it just took me hours and hours and hours to read. This is a 600-page Russian novel. But I totally immersed myself in it, you know, so I hyper-focused. It took me forever. If I didn't have dyslexia, I could have read it much faster. I didn't write it. That was Dostoevsky. But I loved the world of stories, and I still do. I loved the world of fiction and fables and all that kind of stuff. So I was able to develop my mind, although I have these definite challenges, you know, a wandering mind, you know, the downside of ADD, the mind just goes wherever it wants to go. But that's also the upside of it, you know. So, and that's what's so interesting about ADHD, or as I like to call it, VAST. You know, every symptom has a counter. For every negative, there's a positive. And so, but I'm not a good example. That's why I try to not use myself as an example too often, because I did not suffer the traumas in school that so many kids do. I'm one of the few people you'll ever meet who can honestly say I never had a bad teacher. I only had, you know, not many people can say that. I had wonderful teachers every year, every step of the way, from Mrs. Eldridge right through medical school. God was looking out for me when he handed out teachers.
He sure did. Wow. So I was listening to one of your podcasts the other day, and you stated about how you're writing books more so for keeping busy than perhaps, is it the love of writing books? What is it that draws you in?
Yeah, I don't write books to keep busy. I write books because I have to. I mean, it's what I call my write difficult, you know, and in the book I talk about find your write difficult. It's my creative outlet. For some people, it might be cooking. For others, it might be gardening. For others, it's growing a business. Most entrepreneurs have ADHD. For others, it might be building a boat or designing a park or, you know, whatever it meant. For me, it's writing. And so if I don't have a book going, I get depressed. I've written 21 books. So I don't do it to keep busy. I do it to keep alive, you know, to feel fulfilled. I mean, I need to write books. If I don't, I just don't feel right. Something's missing. As creative outlets go, it's a very unforgiving one because the books are never as good as I wish they were. It's sort of like golf, you know, you're never as good as you wish you were, but you keep coming back, you know, because the good shots are sustaining. And for me, the good sentences and the good paragraphs are sustaining. And I've been lucky enough that there are enough people who like to read my books that publishers keep paying me to write them. So I'm very, very grateful to my readers. I mean, I'd be unemployed without them, you know. So it's a marvelous partnership between writer and reader. It's funny because we don't get to meet the vast majority of our readers, and yet we have a intimate relationship, writing about very private and personal matters, and we create this bond between writer and reader. I wish I could meet them all, but.
Yeah. Well, that's how I feel about podcast listeners is that I wish I could put a face with every name. That would be.
Yes.
That
yes.
connection is.
No, exactly.
Fire for the soul.
You have these wonderful listeners out there and you know, you'd like to go have lunch with every single one of them.
Mama, are you looking for some extra support? Could you use a few more like-minded mamas in your circle? Here is your official invitation to join our Facebook group, the Motherhood and ADHD Community. Here you can ask questions, share advice, but most importantly, know that you're not alone. Click on the link in the show notes or search on Facebook for Motherhood and ADHD Community. So come join our little corner of the internet with other mamas who know how your brain works and won't look at you crazy when you share what's floating around inside there. Instead, they'll say, I get it. I've been there and I know how that is. So come on, what are you waiting for? See you in there. Again, that's the Motherhood in ADHD Community on Facebook.
And a lot of your books you've written with Dr. John Rady. How did you partner up with him?
Well, John was what's called my chief resident. In medical training, when you're a resident, a first-year resident, you have a senior resident who is designated your chief resident. So it's a sort of a special honor to be a chief resident. And John was my chief resident. So he was sort of my first teacher in the practical art of psychiatry. And we became very, very good friends. I love John and still do. We're 40 years later, we're still close friends, writing books together, playing squash together. I've seen him through two divorces. He's on his third wife and is very happy with her, which is great. And his two children, and he's godfather of one of my children. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful friendship. And friendships are so important. Yeats, the poet Yeats, has a great line. He says, think where man's glory most begins and ends, and say, my glory was I had such friends.
Yeah, you talk a lot about vitamin C and connecting with people. And when you have that connection and validation from people who truly know who you are and accept who you are, there's such a freedom with that. Because I think a lot of us spend a good portion doubting ourselves. But when you have those cheerleaders on your side, it makes it.
Yeah, I think for, you know, I've been working with people of ADHD for 40 years. I've met many, many thousands of them. And that negative voice is maybe the single most pernicious element of the condition, that the doubting self, negating self, holding back on life out of fear, using avoidance as a coping style. More than anything else, that's what keeps us from reaching our full potential. I've not yet found a simple way to deal with that, other than encouraging people to try things and then experience some success, and then the voice tends to quiet down. But as I said, I was lucky early on to be a top student, and so I got whatever self-esteem comes from that, I did get. The personal side of my childhood was pretty chaotic, so I did suffer some traumas growing up as well. But as far as school went, that was positive.
How do you think that those interactions change the way that you parent your children?
You mean the troubles that I had in childhood?
Mm-hmm. When you see how you were raised and how you raised your children.
The overriding value that I found growing up, when I found it, was the power of connection. At its most distilled, we call that love. As many people with ADHD, I'm a dreamer. I'm a visionary. I have a mission. And at its simplest terms, my mission is to spread love. You know, that sounds hokey maybe, but it's real. And it is the most powerful force in the world. I mean, people get nervous talking about it because it sounds, you know, too close or too hokey, but it is. There is no force in life that is more generative, formative, healing, promoting growth than love. And then, you know, it doesn't have to be full-on love. It can be like, you know, it can be affiliation, attachment, admiration, just feeling good about people. But that force, wherever you find it, you will find growth. You will find people being real. And when you're real, you can develop your best, and it's, you have permission to fail. You know, you have low fear, high trust kind of thing. And I was lucky, as chaotic as my childhood was, everyone, with the exception of one person, was loving. The one person who wasn't was my stepfather, who was a mean man, very much alcoholic and really sadistic. And I suffered with him from the time my mother married him when I was, how old was I? I guess 6. Until the time that she sent me away to boarding school when I was 10. So those 4 years with him were very painful and unfortunate. And, you know, he had his own demons. His first wife had committed suicide in a very gruesome way. And he was a very literary man himself and sort of fell in with that sort of cynical New York literary culture and kind of scoffed at love, I would say. He thought that was a fable. And so he showed me the power of meanness and the power of the opposite of love. And I guess I learned from that. You know, I learned the hard way, as most people do, what it's like to be without love. Although my mother was always there to provide it, she was also, he drew her into the drinking. So she was, you know, often out of it because of alcohol. And so 4 years of alcoholism, sadism. But thank God, I got sent away to boarding school when I was 10 years old. Most people think in this country, that's pretty awful. But in fact, it was wonderful. I was sent to a school outside of Boston called Fessenden, and no one was drunk there, or at least as far as I could tell, they weren't drunk. And they were kind, and they were consistent, and they were fair, and they were, you know, encouraging people to do well and sort of set high goals and do your best and all that kind of stuff. That it really, I was fertile ground. I was like parched soil, and they started watering it. And oh my gosh, did I ever start growing? Because I'd not been getting that. I mean, you know, my mother and stepfather didn't care what grades I got. They didn't even care if I went to school or not. They just wanted me out of the house. And so suddenly I had teachers who cared. I had teachers who noticed, and other kids, you know, I made friends. It became my family, and I flourished there. I really blossomed at that school from the moment I got there. It was like, at last, the parched soil is being watered, and guess what? It's fertile soil. It can grow. And thank God, you know, that really did that. Those 4 years at that school completely saved my life. I know for a fact, I'm now 71. I would be dead today, or alienated, probably alcoholic, depressed, and homeless, you know. But because of that school, I've done okay and been able to develop my talents, at least somewhat, and have offered something to the world and raised three children, and with a wonderful wife of 32 years.
Well, thank you for being so vulnerable. I think it's really important that people with ADHD hear, because most people with ADHD have endured some sort of trauma in their background, to know that there is that light on the other side, that you can take those obstacles and that pain and turn it into something that you can utilize for good if you want to. It's hard, but we can take those struggles and turn them into helping others.
It usually requires some form of connection, some form of positive connection with a mentor, a coach, a teacher, a grandparent, a friendly janitor. I mean, it can be anyone who you connect with, who you like. I had one patient who indeed said he got through grade school because of the janitor. And they would meet with each other, and he'd tell them how much he hated school. The janitor would say, "Oh, don't worry, they're not so bad." And he'd encourage him and say, "You're a smart kid." And he'd say, "Really, you think so?" He'd say, "Yeah, I know you are." And so wherever you find someone who believes in you, that's what you need. Somebody who gets a kick out of you. Somebody who smiles when they see you coming. And unfortunately, for a lot of folks with ADHD, people don't smile when they see us coming. They go, "Oh my gosh, here comes another headache. Here comes another late paper. Here comes another inappropriate remark or some prank," or, you know. So we're not always greeted with open arms. But if you find one person, it only takes one who greets you with open arms and really sees that you do have something to offer in life. That makes all the difference. It makes all the difference. And that's where love becomes practical, because then they encourage you to develop skills. And confidence is all about developing skills. You don't get confident by being told you're good. You get confident by proving to yourself and to other people that you can do things well. You know, whatever it might happen to be, from shooting a basketball to solving a math problem to playing an instrument to starting a business. Whatever it happens to be, if you can do something well, you will become confident. And the other hand is, so many folks with ADHD don't have that experience. They only experience doing things poorly and being called out for it, you know, punished for it, ridiculed for it, diminished for it, or they get punished for being who they are.
Yeah.
My friend Dave Pilkey, the man who wrote Captain Underpants, I mean,
he's one of our favorite authors here at the Song House.
You know, you're not alone. I mean, he was paddled in school almost every day from about age, you know, second grade all the way through high school. He went to this Lutheran school where they took a big board and beat you on your butt. And he got that regularly. And he was usually paddled for making people laugh, for having, you know, his great talent, his imagination. But Dave, you know, like so many people with ADD, he was so resilient. Instead of becoming a broken, bitter, angry man giving up on life, he became one of the greatest writers of children's stories who's ever lived. I mean, his books have sold over 80 million copies. I mean, that's an incredible number. And kids adore him. You know, when I mention his name, I feel like I'm name dropping, because the kid will say, "You know him? Oh my gosh." You know, and he's the sweetest man in the world, has a wonderful Japanese wife. Your husband is Chinese, his wife is Japanese, and they don't have any children of their own, but they have 80 million children. And he is devoted to the kids. He will send them books. He'll send them material, paraphernalia, whatnot. It's just an incredibly sweet man. But the way his life, but on the other hand, aside from being paddled at school, he had two parents who completely believed in him. Why they didn't take him out of that school, I don't know. But they totally believed in him and encouraged him to, you know, draw his cartoons and develop his sense of humor. And now he's one of the most lovely men you'd ever meet.
Mama, I do not want to pause, but I don't want the episode to get too long. So be sure to hit subscribe so that the next episode shows up right away and you'll get part two of my conversation with Dr. Hallowell. Next week, we're talking with Ned about parenting with ADHD and how to repair when we lose it on our kids, because we are going to lose it on our kids. We also discuss how the DSM doesn't cover a major part of ADHD, emotional regulation. And how can we work towards changing the perception of ADHD in society as a whole? We also talk about ADHD medication and the plethora of misinformation out there, as well as his advice as a parent who's now on the other side. I'll talk to you soon, Successful Mama. For more resources, classes, and community, head over to my website, motherhoodinadhd.com.